Alonzo.
Dave.
Husband.
Husband.
Did you know that this episode of Hee Haw, I'm sorry, this episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Ovid?
I did know that.
You're supposed to say, no, I didn't know that. Like, it's a surprise. Like, oh. You're continuously surprised by the joy that Ovid brings to your life.
What? I had no idea.
It's a bit. Say yes.
Yeah, no, I did say yes, and now but, you're telling
by,
me to
by,
say
by
no.
Saying no, you're saying yes.
I did not know follow that Ovid bit. Was sponsoring this show. All right, what stop a delightful talk. Surprise.
Stop talking. I'm going to give you the information.
Please do.
In the words of IndieWire, your friend and mine, IndieWire, Ovid continues to be a strong choice for curious streaming viewers who trust smart curation to lead them off the beaten path. Path. And the platform's November slate is, in the words of the copy, all killer, no filler.
Whoa.
Leonard Cohen obsessives, you should not miss Caroline Leaf's Ladies and Gentlemen, Mr. Leonard Cohen, a 1965 documentary.
No kidding.
Yeah, oh, that follows Mr. Cohen as he returns to his hometown of Montreal to, quote, renew his neurotic affiliations.
All artists should.
What I love about this week's crop of stuff that they're telling us about is it's all Canadian.
Oh, all right. Then.
We dream of Canada.
Totally.
A lot. Like, we think it would just be a better place to be than here. They've got their problems. Obviously, I've been reading the news lately. But,
yeah, but we have... The United States has managed to become Canada's rancid basement.
Yeah. This week, they're also premiering two documentaries on pianist Glenn Gould.
Oh, nice!
Glenn Gould, Off the Record, where he enjoys a respite at his lakeside cottage, revealing an aspect of himself previously known only to the collie pacing beside him through the woods. Hmm. And then there's Glenn Gould, On the Record, where he goes to New York City, and you see the renowned Canadian concert pianist kidding the cab driver, bantering with sound engineers at Columbia Records, and then, alone with the piano, fastidiously recording Bach's Italian Concerto. Wow. There are three historical Canadian films. Churchill Island, which was the first National Film Board of Canada film to win an Academy Award.
Huh.
There is City of Gold, which is a collage of still photographs that compare the Dawson City of the Gold Rush to the more tranquil Dawson City of the present.
Okay.
And then King of the Hill, which follows one of the greatest Canadian baseball players of all time, Ferguson Jenkins. I've never heard of him until today. Through his apparently legendary 1972-73 season.
So clearly they are gunning hard for the Guy Branum audience.
They're gunning hard for the me audience, honestly, because, I mean, we're almost done with Letterkenny.
That's true. You're
We've only got like five
somewhere.
Episodes left. Then, you know, there's plenty of Schitt's Creek left to still consume. But you know what? I've heard from some Canadians who say that those two shows don't entirely represent the entire country.
What?
I know.
Well, you can only watch A Place to Stand so many times, I guess.
No, you can watch A Place to Stand over and over and over again still be happy.
You're right.
Okay, anyway, there's also The Royal Journey, which is a documentary about the five-week visit of, here's where we go to Guy Branum territory, Princess Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh to Canada in the fall of 1951.
Ooh.
There's also one called Kate and Anna McGarrickle. I mean, they're hitting all of it here. You just need a documentary about, like,
Degrassi,
Jane Sibbery and Bruce Coburn to get this all wrapped up.
Really bring it home.
It's a profile of Kate and Anna McGarrickle.
Enough said.
This is a really good week for Ovid, you guys.
Yes.
You should subscribe to it. Tell them what they get.
They're all good weeks, but this one in particular. And because you are a Linoleum Knife listener, and that makes you a classy person, they're going to give you a 50% off of your first 3 months at Ovid. Just use the promo code Linoleum, L-I-N-O-L-E-U-M. That's Linoleum at checkout. When you go to ovid.tv, O-V as in Victor, I ID as in David.tv. Do it today.
Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema.
I feel like I've already been podcasting for quite a long time. I don't think that...
You put your shoulder into that spot.
Well, when they send us ad copy, I know we're supposed to, you know, adapt and maybe cut down and stuff. But, like, I guess if it were ads for stuff that we don't actually care about.
Right.
Just people who are like, hey, we'd love to, you know, give you some money to do these spots, I would be maybe a little more perfunctory. But I get so excited when we read the Ovid and Film Movement stuff, because Film Movement is coming. Don't worry. Film Movement Plus ad soon, listener. I know you're excited about it. When I read the spots, I'm like, ooh, 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 I have to make time to watch this and this and this. Like, I get genuinely worked up.
Yes. No, I know. Exactly. It's a
it's a rare thing to have advertisers who you think are already really cool.
Yes.
And that's, you know, anyway.
But, like, you know, look.
This is not an ad, by the way. We did the ad.
Yes.
Before the theme music. We're just chatting now.
It's not like somebody's coming here for, like, you know, I'm trying to think of a product that we wouldn't be excited about, but I, you know.
Remember when Audible was with us? Remember when Audible did us for about a month? We had about four episodes where we pushed Audible. Because at one point, Audible was just throwing money at every podcast.
Sure, to see what stuck to the wall.
And then finally, when we were done with the 4 weeks, they were like,
Okay, bye.
Y'all are too small potatoes for us to even deal with. Which is a fact. But, like, I don't actually care about Audible. I mean,
I like an Audible.
They do good things. Like, they're a cool company.
It's just not your...
But I just don't really listen to a lot of books via the audio method.
I see.
You know, if it's someone who I know has a speaking voice that I really want to listen to while they read their own work,
mm-hmm.
sure.
Yes.
The Parker Posey book, for example.
Yes, the aforementioned Guy's
book. Like, it would be... That's different.
Yeah.
But in general, like, I don't care if you've got Natalie Portman reading your book. I just don't care. And that's... And I like Natalie Portman, but I just don't care.
Right. I hear you.
And so it's... What is there a book that she reads on Audible that is supposed to be great or something?
You're the one that pulled Natalie Portman out of your hat. I have no idea.
You gave me a face that was sort of like, oh, don't be mean to Natalie Portman.
Well, I'm feeling tender toward Natalie Portman. I just watched Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium again last night.
That's true. And that's probably why she was in my head. Because every time I walked through the living room, she was there.
Yes.
Being
a gamine.
Being magical.
Don't ish talk Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium. That movie holds up.
I guess it does. I mean,
for those of us who actually like it, which apparently I'm in the minority if you look at the Rotten Tomatoes.
Page. I liked it, I think, when it came out.
You did.
I have forgotten entirely about it. Mm. I'm sorry to say. I didn't mean to forget about it. But
you've seen a lot of movies since
then. My brain is a sieve.
Like, the three only, times yesterday you brought up something that I should totally have remembered. I'm like, nope, I got nothing. I have no. We did that. We saw that.
To be fair.
To be fair, the
Last of Mrs. Cheney is a good movie.
Uh-huh.
But it's been a rough year, and I'm not surprised that you forgot that we watched it earlier in the calendar.
Maybe we have hit that stage of life where we have to start taking ginkgo biloba.
Is that the memory stuff?
That is the memory stuff.
I mean, we are old.
We are.
I mean, like, we're really old.
No, we know people who are really
old. No, let me tell you about how so old we are. Yesterday on Twitter, some kid.
Oh, I saw this.
Some effing fetus child said,
zygote.
Imagine being alive when Crazy in Love came out. And I was like, first of all, young person, I don't even know. I don't know who it was. And I really should have gone deeper in to find out so I could say, see here, young man.
Yes.
Young lady. I was 39.
Yeah. No, that tweet got around because even people we know, like, in their early 30s were like, excuse me. Why don't you just say, imagine being an adult?
I did appreciate that, though, because, you know, if you were born in 2002, mm-hmm. you're 18 this year.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're a grown person.
You know, I,
at this point, and that means you were in diapers when Crazy in Love came out.
Like, I, you know, have, as I've mentioned before, I'm the youngest of seven.
You've never known a period in your, listen, here's how lucky you are. Uh-huh. You've never been aware of a time in history when that jam did not exist. What a pleasure.
There you go. Lucky you.
Well, the rest of us had to live for 39 whole damn years before Beyonce gave us the gift
All we
of
had
Crazy
was
in Love.
The other song with the horn section that they sample in Crazy in Love.
Which is also a good song.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I was born a youngest child. So, like, I went through my early years very constantly aware that things occurred before I was born.
Before you were born. Yeah, I know.
But boy, the people who think that,
well,
like,
we didn't have a choice. Before, well, you and I were the last generation of people who were born into a world where there were no VCRs.
Correct.
There was no cable television.
Correct.
There was no internet.
Yes.
There were no cell phones. We were born and remember a time as children when there was the radio,
mm-hmm.
television, right. that had three major networks,
yes.
and the movies.
And the cheap way to fill television programming was with old
stuff.
TV shows and movies.
Right. So we were made involuntarily aware,
yes.
that the world was pretty happy before we came along.
Right. Also, we followed a very narcissistic generation that acted like they invented everything.
And we inherited all of their narcissism. And then we passed it down to the millennials and the Gen Z kids.
That's right.
No one is immune.
We paid it forward.
Would you care
mm-hmm.
to discuss some cinema?
Let's
get freaky.
Oh, sure. Why not?
A film that for some reason avoided being released in October when it would have made more sense.
Yeah.
And is now cluttering up the holiday season.
Yes.
With itself.
And it's in theaters, but it will be, I'm sure, streaming probably in December because it's part of the whole Universal narrow window AMC theaters deal.
Yes. Obviously, don't go to a movie theater.
No.
Please don't get COVID.
No, the numbers are bad again.
In a movie theater, the numbers are skyrocketing,
yes.
and it's terrifying. Much more terrifying than this film.
Also,
and
don't gather for Thanksgiving, but that's a whole other topic.
If you are near a drive-in and it's at a drive-in, you can go see it at a drive-in.
There you go.
Otherwise, please wait until the streaming begins. But this is a film that you have said repeatedly at this point mm-hmm. should have been called
Freaky Friday the 13th.
Indeed. Written, directed by, written by Michael Kennedy and Christopher Landon, and directed by Christopher Landon.
Yes.
Who is accomplished horror director.
Oh, very much so.
And has given us two of our favorite recent horror comedies,
mm-hmm.
Happy Death Day, and its sequel, Happy Death Day to You.
Yes. And
did he direct the second one too?
He directed both of them.
I really dig both of those.
Yeah, and if you slept on Happy Death Day to You and thought, sequels are never good.
Fun.
Give it a shot.
So much fun.
It is a lot smarter than you might suspect it
yeah.
is, and it's very entertaining. Both those movies are terrific.
I'm listening to this one.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
But let's talk about what happens.
Okay, so you have a young girl who in sort of classic Hollywood style is, you know, meant to be a bit of an outsider, picked on, kind of a nerd. It played by a gorgeous actress with a slightly unflattering hairdo and a somewhat frumpy wardrobe, you know. So
yep.
It's very she's all that in that respect. That actress is Catherine Newton. She was on Big Little Lies. She has popped up. She was the female lead in Detective Pikachu.
Yes.
Anyway, so she is a senior in high school. She wants to go away to college, but mom is still reeling from the death of her dad, and so she feels kind of trapped at home. Meanwhile, the ideal town in which she lives has a nefarious, legendary serial killer, who somehow exists as like urban legend and lore, even though he is a quite active serial killer.
Right. So people are literally being slaughtered in the town.
Left and right.
But the kids treat it like an urban legend. Like, it's not really this particular serial killer who's doing the serial killing.
Yeah.
It doesn't fully make sense.
No, yeah, I'm unclear on that one. Anyway, so beginning of the movie, said serial killer played by Vince Vaughn comes in, hacks up some teenagers in some, you know, typically cinematically interestingly gruesome ways.
Brutal death in the first 10 minutes of this movie. So much so that you think maybe
this isn't a comedy.
This is not going to be a comedy, but no, it's going to be a comedy, and you just have to get over that first 10 minutes of people being
slaughtered.
Yeah, real, like blunt force kind of death. Just FYI.
You know, a trophy that he happens to pick up at that house is this mystical dagger. Mm. And then later in the film, when he stabs our heroine Millie with it at midnight, wouldn't you know it, their souls swap bodies. And now Millie, inside the body of Vince Vaughn, has 24 hours to fix things. Meanwhile, the serial killer in the body of Catherine Newton is suddenly dressing better and taking out all of Millie's oppressors. Even though, I guess the movie establishes that they oppress serial killer in Millie's body as well, because it's not like he would just know.
Right.
But, you know, even though, you know, Millie does not have the upper body strength that Vince Vaughn does, the killer still figures out a way to kill.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're right. I think that opening sequence, I think, is kind of what throws this thing off kilter. And it's not that horror comedies can't be gory. I just rewatched Shaun of the Dead for Who Shot Ya, and you know there's some zombies eating entrails and stuff in that movie, but like later, you know, they work to that, and then you know I think it doesn't take you out of it the way that this movie kind of doesn't nail the tone. And Happy Death Day, both those movies have kills in them.
They're
PG-13 kills, but kills nonetheless. This one doesn't quite swing that that balance as well.
I was ready for a very different film based on that first, you know, sequence of murders. I am not opposed to the mean-spirited kill.
No.
In a horror movie. In fact, for me, a horror movie isn't truly horrific unless I feel awful at some point through the film or when it's over based on the cumulative ugliness of what has just transpired.
Fair.
So I was sitting there watching it thinking, okay, you know, and then it shifts gears and becomes the Valley Girl musical without the singing.
That's a fairly apt comparison.
But then also about a serial killer.
And we liked the Valley Girl musical.
Yeah, it's fine. And so inside while watching, I went back and forth. I felt like Christopher Landon knows how to make this kind of movie. Yeah. And I'm wondering what happened to make it feel so erratic. Because I don't want to tell you it's bad. It's not bad.
No.
It's entertaining.
And there are laughs that land, and there are scary parts that land. They just don't seem to be in the same movie.
I'm just ready for something more consistently good, like the Death Day films.
Yeah.
And didn't he direct one of the
he's one of the architects of the whole Paranormal Activity franchise too, and of course, son of Michael Landon.
Correct. Sure.
It's
irrelevant.
It's an interesting footnote.
Footnote. It's somewhat irrelevant here. But what might be relevant for my own enjoyment of this particular film is that I will confess that I've got kind of a thing about Vince Vaughn. I'm not into it. I don't like him. Just in general, I don't like him.
Somebody was talking about how he's one of those people who is the same in every film.
Yeah. I'm not immune to subjective personal tastes. Film critics who claim objectivity are liars.
Of course.
And I just don't... He's a conservative dick. And
we have Fat Man to get to in this episode.
Oh, I know. Don't think that I won't go there with that man too. And I am not down for his entire career.
Wow. Okay. How
about that?
Okay.
So watching him be what I know he is in a film where he has to inhabit the gender binary in such a silly way, you know, that
better or worse than Rob Schneider in The Hot Chick.
This is all in the same category to me. You know, why can't all people be as Bugs Bunny is what I'm trying to say.
Well, that is a goal for all of us.
And that is, you think I'm joking, but the gender nonconformity of Bugs Bunny. If you are like, if you are going to play against what you are as a performer,
yeah,
aim for Bugs. And that's not what Vince Vaughn can do or is willing to do.
I mean, he
really bothers me.
I think part of the problem is the movie doesn't establish Millie as that interesting a character that you can then recognize her in someone else.
There's also that.
You know, like if she were more specific, then he would have something more specific to be playing.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen as much. I didn't mind him. The only part that bugged me was
the kiss.
Yeah, the kiss. There's a whole subplot about like there's a cute boy and Millie likes him, but they haven't really talked and she's too shy. And then suddenly in the body of Vince Vaughn, she finds the confidence to finally start flirting with him and he starts flirting back and they eventually kiss. And you know, like if Judd Apatow had directed this movie, they would have gone for it. No questions asked.
Of course.
And in this movie, they come in and they start the kiss and then Vince Vaughn brings his hand up.
Up to his mouth. Like when the girls in Tattoo would pretend to make out with each other. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. Fake lesbian Tattoo.
Yeah. So it's such a coy move. And I was like, oh, come on, Vince Vaughn. Like in for a penny, in for a pound. Like don't give us these half measures. So that was annoying. I liked Misha Osherovich from The Goldfinch as the gay friend. I thought he was funny. I liked Celeste O'Connor as the other friend of the lead. The mom is played by Katie Finneran, who I've been a fan of. She was on Wonderfalls, and she's done a lot of Broadway. You're right. There are things in this movie that work. It's not a bad movie. It's a bit of a disappointment given that Landon has given us these two really great horror comedies, and it is the horror comedy balance where this movie kind of drops the ball.
And if you, again, continuing on with the whole, I'm a big lug of a man and now I'm a teenage girl situation. If you are expecting anything resembling intelligence or nuance regarding the presentation of gender in this film, do not watch it. You're going to be not happy.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Landon is a gay filmmaker and you'd think maybe that would be an area where he would come up with something subversive, but.
And maybe he did. And maybe there were people above him who didn't let that happen.
I was going to say,
we don't know.
This may well, like at some point in the Blumhouse machine, they were like, who knows? We don't know.
We don't know. All I know is that it's, It's fine.
Yeah.
But sometimes also not fine.
Yeah.
Makes sense?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it ever crosses the line to being like flat out offensive. It's just sort
I don't know.
Really? I was going to say, I think it's timid at worst.
Well.
But, you know, your mileage may vary.
All right. There are two things. Oh, you know what we forgot to do?
What's that?
Tell people who we are.
Oh, good heavens.
We started just chatting around, talking about...
Well, we said our names during the spot at the beginning.
Saying things. No, I didn't. I just called you husband.
No, you said Alonzo.
Oh, did I say Alonzo? Anyway. Well, your name is Alonzo Duralde. Yes. You are the reviews editor of The Wrap.
I am.
You are the co-host of What the Flick. You are the co-host of Breakfast All Day. I'll never get over saying What the Flick. And I'll never get over my grudge. You're the co-host of Breakfast All Day. You are the co-host of Who Shot You on the Maximum Fun Network. You are the co-host of the delightful yet generically titled A Film and a Movie on the Bramble Jam Network with Daniel Thompson of Deck the Hallmark fame.
And you are Dave White.
Who I was a film critic up until March, and I still am, but not with written words because... I ain't got no job right now.
But you're here.
But here I am, film criticizing with you.
That's right.
My spouse.
Doesn't get any better than that.
Please talk about Fat Man and Come Away.
Whoa. Okay.
I've seen neither of them. I might get around to Come Away if you tell me I should, but there's no way in hell I'm watching Fat Man because the antipathy I feel for Vince Vaughn is full on seething hatred for Mel Gibson. So, not happening.
You know, I think if there's a theme for this week, it's nice try, and I'm glad you went for this tricky mix of things, and it didn't quite come off. And that applies to Freaky, but it also applies to the two films I'm about to talk about. So, Fat Man is it's an attempt to kind of do a 70s, specifically 70s action movie, like something along the lines of, like, you know, Point Blank.
Yeah.
But also be about Santa Claus.
Okay.
And it's a very sort of blue collar Santa, like, you know, he's on a ranch in Alaska and he drives a pickup truck and, you know, he wears jeans and a flannel shirt.
Like a rock.
Exactly. And the premise is that there's many premises going on. Part of it is that because there's more and more naughty children every year, Santa is delivering fewer and fewer presents, which is jeopardizing his arrangement with the U.S. government because the existence of Santa drives the Christmas economy.
Right.
So to make ends meet, he now has to fulfill some contract with the U.S. military using the elves as labor to create, I forget what now. Meanwhile, you have this like awful rich kid, who comes in second at a science fair. And so he hires an assassin played by Walton Goggins to kidnap the girl who won.
Oh, no. See, I like Walton Goggins.
He's the best thing in this thing. To kidnap the girl who won.
I'm resolved.
And basically, like, torture her or threaten her with torture to get her to say that she cheated so that the kid can win the science fair.
Okay.
Anyway, obviously, that kid gets coal in his stocking because he's bad. So he again hires Walton Goggins to assassinate Santa Claus.
All right.
So part of the movie is Walton Goggins stalking his prey and trying to find him and figuring out where he is and going to get him. And Walton Goggins has his own backstory about Santa. Meanwhile, Santa and his, played by Mel Gibson, and his wife, Marion Jean-Baptiste, are dealing with the whole military contract thing. They throw a lot at the wall in this movie, and I get what they're going for, and it doesn't ever quite mix. It's like, you know, they want to be, I think if you took the kid out, maybe it would make more sense.
Take the kid out.
Well, just because it, you know, like if you had Hitman stalking Santa and Santa fulfilling military contract, like that all is on a tonal page, but then the kid is out from somewhere else. It's just bananas.
Mm-hmm.
I have a weird thing about Mel Gibson. Like, I grant you, yes, he is a despicable human being who has done terrible things,
mm-hmm.
and yet he continues to work. And that in itself, I find to be something of a failing. That said...
Failing of the film industry.
Of the film industry.
Yes.
That said, as someone who has to continue to watch his films
yes.
As my job,
Yes.
I would much rather see him in like R-rated movies where he plays characters who are kind of jerks. For example, Bloodfather, where I thought he was really terrific in, then in something like Daddy's Home 2, where he is like an utter misanthrope and misogynist, and we're supposed to find that charming.
I do want to interject here that the films that he has been in the past like 10 to 15 years, where he is, in my, I know he's acting, but in my opinion, my personal opinion, I feel like it's his guts are open on screen, like where he's portraying extremely tortured, brutal, unhappy, miserable people. Mm. I'll watch that. Because that's when I think I'm the psychiatrist and he's on the couch, like, and I go, okay, Mel Gibson, well, you know what, you could, have you considered maybe not being like this? Like, yeah. And but yeah, I know what you mean. And I, back when I was contractually obligated to review anything he did, I would see those films and think, all right, I see you. Never be anything but this on screen until you sort your actual life out.
Right.
But
if you do not want to spend money on a Mel Gibson movie as a matter of principle, I honor that, and I think that makes total sense.
Right.
I have not bought a ticket for anything he has done in a long time because
you don't have to.
I don't have to. You know, but I do have to review the movies like this and Hacksaw Ridge and you know, Bloodfather or whatever. And so yeah, I do still kind of take them on a case by case basis. Look, I've told the story a million times. Tommy Lee Jones was actively a jerk to me, and I still
I witnessed it happen.
Yeah. And I still think he's one of our greatest actors.
He really is. He really is.
Dang it.
It's every time I see Tommy Lee Jones in a movie, I think, oh, you were mean to my husband. I'll punch you right in the face, Tommy Lee Jones.
But you're so good in
this. You're so good in this movie.
So yeah. I would love to know what was going through Marion Jean-Baptiste's mind, you know, working with this gentleman. But, you know, she's good in it. She's always good.
Get
she's
money. Always, she's get always paid. Reliable. Marion Jean-Baptiste, get paid.
Get those checks. Yes. No, I do not object to that. But yeah, Walton Goggins is great. Like, if anybody totally nails the tone that this movie wants to be,
right,
it's Walton Goggins.
Right.
And so, you know, if later on down the line it pops up streaming for free somewhere or a cable that you already subscribe to somewhere, check it out for him. Like, he's the main thing to look at in this movie. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's just kind of like, nice try. I see what you were going for. You didn't quite get it. And then I would also say nice try for Come Away, which is trying to do a lot of things also. It is... God... It's kind of a Peter Pan / Alice in Wonderland origin story.
All right.
And it is very much a kind of like Victorian children's fantasy.
Right.
And it does interesting, there's interesting casting involved in that the parents are played by David Oyelowo and Angelina Jolie.
Yes.
And, you know, Angelina Jolie's character comes from money. David Oyelowo was more like sort of scrappy and poor. And like there's like some criminal element in his family. And okay. So like Angelina Jolie's relatives are very snobby about him.
All right.
So while race is never mentioned in the film,
right,
it does add this element of like, you know, we're looking down on you and you're the up and comer, but you don't really belong here aspect to
I
it.
I see.
That's kind of a cool thing. The movie is throwing a lot at you, and tonally, I'm not quite sure who it's for, because it wants to be a sort of kids movie about imagination and escaping into imagination, but
right,
it's also about, like, death and guilt and, you know, like, maybe escaping into imagination is dangerous and is a thing you should be careful about, but also, since we're doing the Peter Pan story, they have to escape and never come back because he's going to go off with the Lost Boys. And it's like, I don't know what this movie is saying.
I get it.
Or wants to say. But visually, you know, it is, I mean, it's super CG, obviously, but it's gorgeous and it's lovely to look at. And I like the performances a lot. But it's just, at the end of it, I'm like, what was that? And what am I supposed to take away from it? You know, there's like, yeah, there's like loan sharks and all this other, like, it just, I don't know. There's a lot going on, and I don't think it, I think it's one of those movies you're like, wow, one more pass on the script would have really maybe helped. Bring in the dramaturg, because I just don't know what's going on here.
But could you tell me what's going on with Film Movement Plus?
I certainly could. Film Movement Plus presents Tana, which is the debut film from Bentley Dean and Martin Butler, which was nominated for an Academy Award. And comes from the South Pacific. I remember when this film premiered at Venice. In the South Pacific, Wawa, a young girl from one of the last traditional tribes, secretly falls in love with the chief's grandson, Dane. When war breaks out, Wawa becomes betrothed to another man as part of a negotiated peace offering. Unwilling to accept his fate, the young lovers decide to run away. Pursued by enemy warriors seeking retribution, Wawa and Dane must choose between their hearts and the future of their tribe. Tana is based on a true story and performed by the people of Yakel in Vanuatu. And that's just one of the many cool options. In Viva Cuba, two children's budding romance is threatened by their parents' feud, leading them on a beautiful island voyage. So that's a double feature sitting for you right there. The Tribeca film Bending Steel, about a 43-year-old native of Queens, New York, who is in training to become a professional old-time strongman. I don't know if they
What's
make
an
you,
old-time strongman?
You know, like the guys who would bend the bars and stuff. I don't know if they make you grow the mustache if you're going to be an old-time.
You kind of have to grow the mustache, don't you?
I would think, but I don't know if it's requisite.
The mustache has to come first, because if you do all that work. You do all that work of being a giant old-fashioned strongman, and then you cannot grow the mustache.
What was even the point?
Now I got to watch this movie.
Maybe the documentary has answers.
I do like a big strong man.
There's a doc about Famous Nathan, the hot dog king of Coney Island.
I also love hot dogs.
I know you do.
I shouldn't, but I do.
So that's just a sprinkling of the many cool titles that are available at Film Movement Plus, always with the interesting and unusual films from around the world, features, docs, shorts, you name it. Absolutely worth checking out every month. There's always new stuff.
They're like Ovid's cousin, you know, like our two advertisers. Yes. What might not be on one is on the other.
There you go.
And you want all of it.
You do.
I do.
It's all should be all part of this.
I always just figured that anyone listening. Yeah, I always just figured that anyone listening wants the same things we want. Why would they listen if they don't?
Fair enough.
I mean, there are plenty of other podcasts that won't go on and on and on about, you know, the restoration of Bela Tarr films from 1987.
And yet here you are. Well, the folks at Film Movement Plus, they do adore our listeners. And as such, they're going to give you a 30-day free trial and 50% off your first three paid months using the promo code KNIFE at checkout, KNIFE. When you go to filmmovementplus.com, it's all there for you.
Go do that.
Yes.
Next.
Yes.
On this here linoleum knife.
Oh, boy. Are we going to the holler?
No, we're going to ammonite.
Oh, okay.
We're going to 19th century windswept, freezing water cold England, the year 1840.
For Dave White, this is rom-com weather.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I was just telling someone last night, the 6 months I spent in London, I don't remember the sun. Like, this is a long time ago. I was in college, but like, sheer bliss. Nonstop rain, slate gray skies, January to June. And I was like, what happens when the sun comes out here? Does the sun come out here?
Well, apparently on the day the sun comes out, there's like 20 movies being made, because every British movie is like these rolling glens of green fields.
Obviously, I'm exaggerating. The sun would come out like for some of the day, pretty much each day. But, you know, the overwhelming
It only rains in British movies when Hugh Grant is
the
sad.
Overwhelming meteorology situation for me while I was there was, it's cold, it's gray, and it's raining. I'm in heaven with that.
So yes, Ammonite is very damp.
From writer-director Francis Lee, yes. Who gave us God's Own Country.
Yes, another movie about cold gay people.
Yeah. in this fossil hunter.
Yes.
Mary Anning.
Archaeologist? Is that the word? I'm not quite sure what the terminology even is for this. Fossil hunter will do.
Okay. I'm sure there's a name for it that we don't know. She, her work has been sort of, you know, dismissed by the men.
Mm-hmm.
So she lives alone with her old mother mm-hmm. by the sea, and she collects and gathers and studies and does scholarly research on the fossils that she collects. She runs a shop. She sells them to enthusiasts and also to museums.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't mind buying her her work.
But they'll erase her participation. Yeah.
She is justifiably not especially pleased with humanity because of this.
Yes.
So when Saoirse Ronan and Saoirse Ronan's husband come along, her name is... what is her name? Charlotte, sorry. Yes. When her character Charlotte shows up with her husband, and she's there to convalesce after we... sort of pieced together that she has had a miscarriage.
Yes.
And is subsequently depressed. And the doctor, of course, recommends taking the sea air mm-hmm. because it's 1840.
Worse, swimming in the ocean.
Yeah, go swim in the ocean. The husband is like, is it okay if I leave her here for 6 weeks with you? Because, you know, you're a lady and you understand. And bye, here's some money. That's basically what happens.
Yeah, it's basically, I have to go see the world, and you're being a womany woman, so I'm just going to park you here with this other woman.
Yeah. She'll take care of you later.
I came here to learn from her because she's much better at this gig than I am, but, you know, also she's going to caretake because, that's just how the world
works. That's just, So, for the money, Kate Winslet does. And very much sort of in the vein of Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah.
They get close.
Yes.
And fall in love, would we say?
I would say that.
Yeah. And the reason my voice went up at the end of that sentence is because... tonally, this is a different film entirely.
Yeah, sure.
Portrait of a Lady on Fire, even though narratively, plot-wise, there are a lot of similarities.
The period trappings and whatnot.
And the sort of fully developed, evolved womanhood of Portrait of a Lady on Fire is a much... colder, more brittle, more distant situation here. And that is because primarily I think this becomes a character study mm-hmm. of Kate Winslet's character, Mary, who has been burned everywhere she goes.
Yeah.
Professionally, in life, romantically. We find out through an older woman in the town Fiona Shaw plays.
Yeah.
And so she is drawn to Saoirse Ronan, but is simultaneously not about to break down anything that has already been built up in her life.
Yeah, she's throwing up a lot of walls.
But
at the same time, I want to give away the final act.
Right.
I think that she is very justified in... the parameters that she creates for herself and the agency that she demands to maintain.
Yes. So what I was going at earlier when I said the sort of fully developed womanhood of Portrait of a Lady on Fire is that that is a film that sort of very generously allows its characters to be everything they feel like being, everything they know they are, and also in community with other women in their area. This film is primarily about the thwarting of that, the isolation, the distance, and the inability sometimes that people have with giving themselves the gift of love and of affection and of, you know, connection to other to other people. And therefore, it's a much more, I wouldn't call it like an old school, you know, sad gaze, stay sad.
No.
But it's not, you know, happy gays get happy either.
Right. Neither was Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I mean,
I understand, but
and I think
they
there is...
get to taste it in Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And I know I probably shouldn't just compare these films.
Yeah.
But they did come back to back in subsequent years. They are thematically similar. They are set in the 19th century, or Portrait of a Lady is set even earlier, I think.
I think so. Yeah.
And go on.
Well, and also I think it raises the question of like, what is it about these period queer romances that are more amenable to mass audiences than something that is set more recently? Like, is it easier to set them in a time where just to be a woman was already like this, you know, society was shoving you to the side, much less to be a queer woman.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, somehow it seems like, I don't know, they have fewer hurdles or something. I don't know.
I think that
the dresses are better.
When we watch a contemporary queer drama where the characters have, we assume,
license,
access to the same, you know, liberty that we have.
Sure.
You know, we think, why don't you get off your ass and let somebody love you? You know, it's easier that way.
Sure.
Here, you look back and you put a filter on it and you think, well, life was already a struggle.
Yeah.
You know, for anyone who wasn't a white guy who owned property. And so if you have extra hurdles, extra obstacles, I think it becomes easier for a contemporary audience to look at that story and think, well, that's why everything's screwed up, because it's 150 years ago. And that's not, I think, the film's fault for setting itself there.
No, not at all. It's a phenomenon. I'm curious what that's about.
There's an element of, oh, we're so much more enlightened now.
True.
You know what I mean?
Let's pat ourselves on the back.
We are. It allows us to do that. And I think one of the things that a film like this can do is give a line, you know, provide a line of experience from who we are now to who we were
centuries ago.
Century ago, two centuries ago, however many. Human emotions don't necessarily change and evolve like very much. I mean, people had the same feelings of longing and loneliness and horniness then that they do now.
Yeah.
It's just about, you know, what are the constraints placed upon them?
Right.
And how many of those constraints are we still experiencing?
Well, yeah, because
we've just inherited.
God's Own Country is a contemporary film.
It is.
Most of the constraints seem to be completely self-inflicted.
Ish. Yeah. Anyway, filmmaking wise,
lovely.
Quiet, controlled. Unhappy yet absorbing, and a great Kate Winslet performance.
Yes.
It is difficult, I think, sometimes for people to look at a performance that is largely sort of brooding and quiet. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're going to talk about Hillbillyology in a moment, where the performances are
anything but
the opposite of brooding and quiet. Actors who are doing the work of
active silence
are doing a kind of work that goes unnoticed a lot of the time. Not that Kate Winslet's character is silent in this film, but she keeps to herself quite a bit. She has been abused by life.
She closes herself off, and that is hard to make cinematically compelling. And
but she does it. Yeah, I find this going back to Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I find this film to have more in common with God's Own Country mm-hmm. than Portrait of a Lady on Fire in terms of its, you know, in terms of its character building.
Yeah,
because the men in that film are similar to the women in this film. They are cut off from themselves. They're cut off from each other. They are quiet people.
Right. Well, and there's also like, even in that case, there's a language barrier.
Also, you know, as well.
And I think both of those films and Portrait of a Lady on Fire play out against these landscapes of vivid nature, you know, whether it's the roaring surf or the, you know, the cold of the where the sheep, you know, are being gathered or whatever. Like, these characters exist in the elements.
All three of these films, and now of course these other two that are from Francis Lee, the natural world becomes a force.
Yes.
It is where they're. It's where the action plays out, but it's also driving them, in many ways. It's part of what inhibits them. It's part of what pulls them to each other.
Yeah.
And so it's a really vivid. I don't want to be a cliche and say it's a character.
How's that? New York is a character.
It is a dramatic element.
Yes.
And that's something to be paid attention to when you're watching the film.
So yeah, Ammonite is currently in theaters. Wait, it will be streaming very soon.
Is it not currently already streaming?
It is not streaming yet. It will be in early December.
Are we talking about any movies this week that are currently streaming? That are they all just in theaters for now?
they might be. I don't know. I hadn't really sat down and thought about
Sorry,
it.
Sorry, everyone. Don't go to a movie theater, please.
No, just think of this as notes for for future viewings. Notes. In the meantime, you have Ovid and Film Movement Plus to entertain you. So
that is correct. I'll tell you another thing. Back before the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
we would talk about films all the time that were nearly impossible to get a hold of.
This is true.
Unless you were in a big city,
true.
You would have to wait like 6 months, a year to get to when they finally came out on DVD or Blu-ray or streaming.
Right.
Here we go. That's just the world now.
Yeah.
For everybody, everywhere, all the time. Sometimes everything's available to you instantly.
Yeah.
Sometimes
not so
you
much.
Gotta wait. Would you like to know about something else, Alonso Duralde?
I always do.
You know what this episode? Do you know what this episode marks for the very first time in 10 years plus one episode?
Tell me.
The very first time that we have had not one, not two, but three advertising spots.
So pretty and popular.
Amber Petty.
Mm.
She's a freelance writer.
Yes.
But she also teaches you. So how to be a freelance writer.
Ah, okay.
Are you a freelance writer? Or would you like to become one? You don't know where to start? Guess what you got to do? Pitch.
That's right.
Do you know what sucks?
Pitching.
Oh, God.
The worst.
I've been a freelance writer for 20 years. I do not pitch well ever at all.
Well, you used to work at a magazine where your pitches were greeted with disdain to your face.
It'll kind of turn you off of it.
Fair enough. You've been burned before.
I should take Eber's course.
Maybe you oughta.
The name of Amber Petty's workshop is called The Pitch is Back.
Yes, it is.
Very clever. How to pitch magazines, publications, and newspapers, or any kind of papers. Five of Amber's recent students got pitches picked up in this past month with no previous samples. Now, that sounds like actual witchcraft. Like, because I have never cold call. No, wait, no, I did cold call someone once and it worked.
Yes, that was true. Weird.
But I had samples.
Yes.
Yeah. They were dumb samples, but they were still samples.
Yeah. Her students know things.
In her 90-minute workshop, you will find out what is a pitch, how to craft a pitch for a story or an essay, what to do if you don't have samples, where to pitch, how to find editor contact information, how to follow up without being annoying.
Oh, as an editor, I appreciate that.
That's the one. That's really, like, you can learn mechanics, but if you can learn how not to be a pest.
I've gotten very good at responding to the first email only because I don't want to respond to the second email.
Right.
But there is an art to writing that second email because a lot of times people are like, oh, I didn't even see this, but that's a great idea. Let's do that.
You'll get a chance to get live pitch feedback, a Q&A with all your questions. You'll write a pitch during the class. By the end of this 90-minute workshop, you will have a rough draft pitch, know what to do with it, and have some tools to conquer the "but who actually cares about my idea" voice in your head. Will that voice be obliterated at the end of 90 minutes? No. Is it guaranteed your pitches will sell? No. If Amber could sell those things, her class would cost approximately $1 million. But you will learn the A to Z to pitching and earn yourself some money. So, here's how much it costs. $147.
Except.
Which is an unusual amount of money to charge for. It's like not an even number.
I'm sure there's a calculation involved.
Yes.
However, if you
are a Linoleum Knife listener, I got the copy right in front of me. You don't have to. You just don't worry your pretty little head. I got it going. I'm in control right now.
Okay.
I'm driving this bus.
All right, Kate Winslet.
I'm Sandra Bullock driving the bus. Just hang on.
You're a gigantor.
If you're a Linoleum Knife listener, this workshop is only $120. Use the code Linoleum, LINOLEUM, at checkout. The workshop times, and this is a time specific thing.
Yes,
we're recording this on a Monday morning. These workshops are this week.
Yes,
Thursday, November 19th at 5:30 Pacific. Saturday, November 21st at 11 a.m. Pacific.
5:30 p.m. Pacific.
Yes, 5:30 p.m. Go to Amber Petty, AmberPetty.com/join. Get it.
And use the code Linoleum at checkout.
All right. Hillbilly mother effing Ellen.
I'm definitely letting you drive the bus on this one.
All right. In 2016, the memoir Hillbilly Elegy was released, and it immediately became a sensation because folks who decided to write about it and talk about it assumed and decided for the world that it was meant to help you understand the folks who voted for Donald Trump.
Would you say coastal elites were writing these pieces?
Well, as a coastal elite...
Your brethren and sistren in the coastal?
It's all their fault.
Okay.
I say there and not me because I was not out banging the drum for this book.
No.
However, I was also not out crapping on this book because I have never read this book. What I did read, though, were the controversies about whether or not the author, J.D. Vance, even had the authority to write this book. Well, of course he did. It's a memoir. He wrote about his own experience. And his own experience, according to the film version, and I'm assuming the film hews pretty closely to the book in this regard, he grew up in Ohio and spent his summers with his family in Kentucky. And one of the controversies, the way I understand it, is that because he wasn't in Kentucky the entire time that he was a child, that he ain't no hillbilly and is not allowed to write this book.
No elegies for you.
We'll get to what I think about that argument in a moment. But here's what happens in the film. Young J.D., is living with his mother, played by Amy Adams. And she is an addict of various drugs. Prescription drugs.
Opioids.
Opioids, eventually heroin. This is all taking place in the late 90s, early 2000s. And she's a disaster. Former nurse, she lost her job because of her drug use, and she's raising JD and his older sister, and her parents have to step in and help raise the kids because she is not handling herself or her children in a functional way.
Well, her mother, by the time that this happens, her father has died.
Let's get our names and pronouns properly accomplished here. Amy Adams is the mom.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Close is the grandmother in this film, and I assume in the book as well, known only by the name Mama.
Right.
Bo Hopkins, known only by the name Papaw.
Mm-hmm.
His character dies fairly early on, and so what we are left with is matriarch, daughter, played by Amy Adams, and the grandkids.
Yes. Haley Bennett from Swallow plays the sister.
Yes. Things get bad, and then things get worse. And it is an endless cycle of poverty, addiction, violence, and despair. When J.D. eventually winds up simply living with his grandmother entirely, it all clicks for him one day that if he is going to get out, he has to take whatever opportunities come his way. He does pretty well in school, so he doubles down on that. He and his grandmother lack appropriate and not even just appropriate, but they lack enough food to eat.
Mm.
So he goes and gets a teenage job in a market. Inch by inch, claws his way out. Graduates from high school, joins the military, serves in Iraq, goes to, I think, Ohio State?
Ohio State, yeah.
And then eventually to law school at Yale, which is where the bulk of the action takes place. We meet him there, and he is called back from law firm internship interviews to go back to Ohio to deal with his mother who has overdosed, try to get her into a rehab, try to sort out the family, try to figure out how he's going to rescue all of them and keep rescuing himself.
Yeah, he has to get this internship to cover what his scholarship to law school isn't going to pay for.
Right.
And yeah, so it's like the interview's coming up, but he's got to go home, and it's
money Jenga.
Yeah, that's the framing device. And so most of the young JD stuff we see is flashbacks.
It's all flashbacks, and it's meant to bolster the why behind everything that's happening in the contemporary life of law school aged JD, who's now in his mid-20s.
Yeah.
So that's the plot. Filmmaking wise, this film is from director Ron Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And because it is from Ron Howard, it is a Ron Howard film. And those, with few exceptions, I'm sorry to say, Ron Howard is a filmmaker, in my opinion, who tends to lack a point of view. He is an accomplished mainstream American filmmaker who doesn't have a personality that he imposes on his films.
He's the kind of director that often gets referred to as journeyman.
Yeah, and there's no crime in that.
Yeah.
All right. But often what happens when you are a company man, and that's, I mean, that also sounds damning, but it's not meant to be. It's just that with him, it seems sometimes fairly egregious.
Yeah.
Edges get sanded off, and source material becomes softened to become palatable to as many people as possible.
Like, there could be a discussion about whether or not this was a book that was even worth filming in the first place, but sure. Wherever you fall on that spectrum, you can probably agree that maybe Ron Howard wasn't the guy to direct it.
Unfortunately, I think to avoid as much controversy as possible, Ron Howard might be the guy to direct this film.
I guess.
Because if you go into the book, and this is all based on what I've read, not because I've read the book.
Sure.
But the book, I am told, is a fairly straightforward assertion of J.D. Vance's current value system, which is, hey, poor person, what's your problem? Pull yourself out of the muck.
Yeah.
Do it. Stop being lazy. Mm. Go get yourself together. Hey, person who's addicted, why don't you just get stronger?
Fix yourself.
If anyone out there has read this book and would like to correct me on my perception of what I have heard, please tell me.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you something. I've been reading J.D. Vance's Twitter account. He has recently removed the word nationalist from his bio.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, I know. It's nice. Although, up until very recently, it was part of his bio on his Twitter account.
Yeah.
He is a very conservative man. And recently converted to Catholicism, like in 2017 or something like that. And is not an idiot. He knows what he's doing when he speaks.
Yeah.
And when he uses coded language to talk about social problems, he is not just an economic conservative, he is a social conservative as well.
Yeah, when he finished Yale Law School, he went right to Wall Street and wound up working for Peter Thiel.
Yeah, that dude. He's a venture, J.D. Vance is a venture capitalist now. So in the framework of this story, did he help his family? Did he pull them out? Did he pull himself out and then pull them out too? Yep. So he done good. Right? Does he care what happens to you? Hell no. But you're not going to see that in this film.
No.
It's not. None of that stuff is in this movie. It's hinted at from time to time.
And it's also there in what they don't talk about.
Yes. It's hinted at from time to time when he says things to Mama, why didn't you put your foot down with her, meaning his mother, as though addiction is something that you can put your foot down about.
Yeah. When good parenting would have fixed all that.
When he learns that Mama had the same problems with Papa, that Papa was an alcoholic and abusive.
Yeah.
It seemingly doesn't change his ideas about what to do with a person in your family who is an addict or an alcoholic. Not only do we not hear about, you know, his extremely conservative social ideas and how he grew to have them, the film also never investigates, because I don't think J.D. Vance cares to investigate, why is the system that creates all these problems still happening?
Right.
Why are we not looking at the reason why there's a busted down former mill town in Ohio?
Yeah.
Where did those jobs go and who made them go away? Well, we don't know. It just happened.
Right.
why isn't there enough food in the house? Is it because Mama is lazy? Well, we don't see her being lazy. We see her doing everything she can possibly do. So why is there no food there? Well, the film doesn't ask that question. Why, in JD's math class, when it is told, when he's told by the teacher that he needs a graphing calculator to do the work, and that graphing calculator costs $80 at the Radio Shack, the film never asks, why isn't the school providing a graphing calculator to the students who are required to use graphing calculators? The film doesn't ask that question.
Nope.
The film refuses to ask all the questions. It doesn't ask about where addiction comes from or why, how to address it mm-hmm. in your family. It doesn't address racial attitudes about folks in the area, the white people mm-hmm. in the area.
Insurance.
It doesn't address health care or health insurance.
Yeah.
It only shows them not having health insurance and having to throw magical credit cards and everything that JD just pulls out of his wallet.
Yeah.
Like, how did JD get all those credit cards? Well, we know how JD got all those credit cards because credit card companies are predatory.
Yes.
And they chase you and try to give you credit cards.
Oh, you're at Yale Law School.
You're at Yale? Oh, well, you're on our credit card list now, yeah. And here we are. Here, just take one.
Yeah.
Thank God he had them, because that way he put his mom into a rehab with him.
Yeah, well, and again...
But the film doesn't address these issues.
All that we know about insurance is that the mom let hers lapse because she's lazy and bad.
And poor and an addict.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are ways that you can get through life if you come from redneck folks. And by the way, this film, J.D. Vance's character, played by Gabriel Basso, by the
yes.
way. At one point, someone refers to him and his family as rednecks. And he says, stoically, we don't use that word. And I'm like, the damn y'all don't. Listeners who may be new to this show, sorry for all of y'all who have listened for years and already know every boring detail about my life. My father came from the Hill People of New Hampshire, not Appalachia. This is relevant. My mom came from a tiny little desert town in southeastern New Mexico. Neither of these communities are especially rich. Neither of these communities were especially interested in education. My grandfather was such a raging alcoholic that my aunt raised my father. My father then became an alcoholic. And then my stepfather was an alcoholic. I've got addicts, 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 and poor folks all through my family. Is J.D. Vance qualified to write about this book, even though he only spent his summers with his, you know, folks in Kentucky? Absolutely. Did he grow up entirely in Appalachia the whole time? No. Does white poverty exist all across the United States and share so much in common that it basically doesn't matter where it's happening? Yes. So, I've been to Kentucky one time in my life. But I know these people, because I grew up with these people. These are my folks. These are my people. Now, my brothers and I, we all got out of it, materially speaking. Mm-hmm. You don't really get out of it. I mean, you've got it. It's inside you. And that can do things to you. It can turn you mean, it can turn you hard, and it can turn you into a, I'm climbing up out of the, I got this ladder, and I'm pulling it up behind me. Oh, are you my immediate family? Sure, coming up the ladder with me too. The rest of y'all, you're on your own.
Get it together,
people. Get it together, yeah. You can become that person.
Yeah.
Or you can become the person who says, why is the world this way? Why is the richest country in the world allowing its people to suffer this way? Why is it okay for people to be hungry? Why is it okay for people to have no health care? Why is it okay for people to have a daily struggle with life? Now, this story happens to be about the white people. And it doesn't address what creates the virulent racism in folks. But that's part of the equation too. It's just that it's not addressed here.
No. And part of the thing about this movie is like, if you'd had, somebody like Kelly Reichardt, somebody like the woman who made Winter's Bone,
Deborah Granik, yes,
you know, Sean Baker, like somebody who is so intuitive about talking about working class white people and poverty. Actually, Sean Baker has made a couple of films about working class people of color, Prince of Broadway and Takeout and Tangerine. Yes.
But this story.
Yes. No, this is absolutely about working class white people. And I think that you're right. Ron Howard is making the palatable, like Ron Howard would have been the guy at MGM who takes the like complicated bestseller and turns it into a nice, you know, blancmange for a broad audience, you know?
Well, the reason that he can't include the complication is because the complication makes everything that much uglier.
Sure.
The complication leads you to J.D. Vance himself.
Right.
Who has turned into an adult who is the barf of puke. who has no interest in, you know, the common good.
Right. Or the systems that create the circumstances that he felt forced to escape from.
It is the most frustrating film I've watched all year because it doesn't have to be this way. And it gives you no insight into why someone would vote for Donald Trump.
No.
You know, the reason I believe that Donald Trump appeals to working class and poor white voters in rural areas is because if you grow up in that area and you are largely in a racially homogenous community where you don't see people of color, where you are only around other white people, and all you see is suffering, you think to yourself, well, we're stuck here, and it must be all those other people out there causing my problems.
Of course, you know? Always.
And so here comes a guy like Donald Trump who says, guess what? It is all those other people out there causing your problems, and I'm your savior.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Now, as a person who knows these characters and has, you know, grown up around these folks, is there anything this movie gets right in terms of
aesthetically,
things that you recognize, things that felt like, okay, yeah, that is exactly what that would look like, or how that would play out, or who that, what
poor,
they would say.
Poor people houses and poor people food and poor people clothes? Yes. I've been reading recently, you know, critics complaining about, you know, calling this poverty porn.
I did that.
Did you?
Yes.
Okay. And I, you know, complaining that the depictions are only surface, and they are right. At the same time, that surfacey stuff is accurate. It's neither good nor bad. I mean, it's like, if you're going to judge someone because they wear clothes you don't like, or live in a house that you think is too tacky or messy, or eat food that you would never touch, you know, the fried bologna sandwich scene that keeps popping up in this movie. You know what? Fried bologna sandwiches are delicious.
I love fried bologna sandwiches. That's not the point.
But that's not the point. The point is that if that's what you're complaining about because you don't like that stuff, then you're part of the problem too.
Okay, but here's the thing: I wasn't complaining because I don't like it. I'm complaining because the film...
No, I know what you weren't. You were talking about how the film doesn't dig deeply past that surface,
and it is showing you stuff. Like, okay, in this movie, the thing that made me crazy is, and you know, J.D. Vance. We see as like he's better than that table full of lawyers who are all snotty and saying things about rednecks in Appalachia and stuff.
Yes.
But he's also better than everybody that he grew up around, with a very few exceptions. Because there's a few like rational conversations that adult JD holds in that town with friends or whatever. But so much of the movie is devoted to like, look at that trash. Look at those people having a fight on their patio.
Yes.
Look at that guy throwing somebody else's clothes out the window.
Yeah.
Look at that person ODing in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
Like, it is gawking.
Yes.
And it's the gawking that I think is the poverty porn.
Yes. Well, you're not wrong.
Yeah.
The film is showing you this stuff to make you go, oh my God.
Yeah, it is standing outside of it and pointing. Yeah. And not in it and understanding.
Unfortunately, all that stuff actually happens.
Sure, but I think I think a more empathetic filmmaker would
know how to. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes, it would. You need material that isn't inherently reactionary.
Yes,
you need a filmmaker that can empathize with suffering people, and you need. An outcome that doesn't blame
the suffering people
for their suffering. Instead, maybe even if all there is critique, even if all there is, hey, this is a problem, not because this person is an inherently bad person, but because this system has broken them down generation after generation, you know, then maybe you'd have a story that would help someone?
Yeah, as I said in my review, if you had a filmmaker who understood Kentucky the way Richard Linklater understands Texas,
right,
this could have been a whole other ball of wax. But what it is, just to me, feels like part tut-tutting and part, like, freak show.
Yeah. And they do call each other rednecks. Listen. Every group of folks has a pejorative. And they all use that pejorative amongst themselves. It is no longer good or polite to use the term white trash. But I'll tell you something. My people. We say it to each other.
Yes.
And that's... And that's me, like, 30-plus years removed from it.
Mm.
You know? Even to the point where, like I said, like all my brothers and I, we're not, you know. They all pulled themselves out. And all of them, including me, had help doing it. Just a little aside, that's another thing this movie plays fast and loose with.
Mm.
Who helped you? Who helped you get out? You're not Hercules. You didn't do it all yourself. You had people putting in good words for you here and helping you out there and taking care of you in this other arena. People helped you. You were lucky. Because people helped you. Because the system you live in doesn't give a damn about you.
Right.
And isn't offering you any help.
So yeah. This is also showing in theaters. It will be dropping on Netflix the day before Thanksgiving. So, you know.
Don't go.
For the holidays.
Honestly, I mean, unless you have some sort of personal connection to the source material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of how you grew up or whatever, and you're just curious.
Yeah,
there's no reason to watch this.
No, and the star turns by Glenn Close and Amy Adams are not their best work.
Let's talk about the acting.
Yeah. Glenn Close is, when you see the real Mamaw in the closing credits.
Oh, everyone looks exactly like the people they're supposed to look like.
Yeah, like that's, you know.
You see the real Mamaw, you see the real mom.
The mom, yeah.
You don't, like, you, they, Amy Adams and Glenn Close look exactly like those women.
Yeah.
They, there's already, I think, some sort of natural resemblance between them all. But, you know, hair, makeup, outfits, the same.
But again, it's like, you know, people talk about, is this a performance that comes from the inside out or the outside in?
Outside
in. This is so outside in. This is so like, I got this wig on and I got these, the makeup department has put these liver spots on my hands and I've got these big, you know, glasses that Mamaw would wear and stuff. And it's so all on the outside. And it's the kind of thing where Glenn Close has become enough of a great lady of the theater that when she does a movie where she flips the bird to somebody and tells them to, you know, sit on it and rotate or whatever, that you can just already feel like, check me out, everybody. I'm getting down and dirty with it. You expect me to be, you know, the great lady, but I'm gonna show you what real America is like. It's like, no, I'm watching Glenn Close giving this performance.
Yes. Yeah. And if you heard that Frida Pinto is in this film, you are right. She is barely as JD's college girlfriend who eventually becomes his wife.
She's mainly there as an exposition machine.
She, like they give her nothing to do.
No.
They cut to her from time to time telling JD how to be, where to go, what the advice for him. Like she's just, she's there. Her character is there to help him figure out what spoon to use at the fancy dinner.
Yeah, and even that scene was kind of like, I bet that moment happened. I don't believe that it happened at that particular juncture of his life.
Who knows?
I don't know. It struck me as very like movie shorthand.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Look, that's the least of this film.
This is a whole movie of shorthand.
The shorthand is the least of this movie's problems. But yeah, you would think, you know, like the idea of you know, are these folks racist? Could have been explored through the Frida Pinto character.
Sure.
It is not.
No.
They it will not touch the subject of racism with a 39.5-foot pole.
Mm-mm.
At all.
Yeah.
And it's just sitting right there.
And if we're supposed to be understanding the Trump voter, that's a key element.
Right.
We have a letter that we should have read during our
shoulda, coulda, woulda.
Our 10th anniversary episode last week. But generally speaking, when we have a guest on, we don't read letters. And so we did not get to it, but we're getting to it now.
This is from Robert. Now, me personally, Dave White, I am made uncomfortable by overt praise.
This will be a good exercise for you.
In public, I would prefer that you just not speak to me. Like, if I'm sitting here with a friend and they tell me something lovely about myself,
mm-hmm.
I feel all full and loving and warm and I want to hug them and, you know, give them more cake. But boy, out in the world, if someone says, Dave White sure does a great job doing blah, 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 I'm like, no, don't talk, stop. Stop talking.
Well, suck it up and read the letter.
So here we go. Congratulations from Australia. Did I say it's from Robert? Robert in Australia. Congratulations on 10 years of Linoleum Knife. I first came to the show in 2015 through What the Flick and have been a devotee ever since. I want to thank both of you for expanding my cinematic palette.
Oh.
Over the past decade, the availability of film and TV has grown at an extraordinary rate. So it's great to have a trusted voices that I can turn to for titles that would otherwise slip under my radar. Some of my favorite memories of the show include reading screenwriter Alan Loeb's far too detailed biography. The recurring subject of War Horse. Discussions of faith-based cinema. Adam Sandler movies, particularly Alonzo's disgust at how Dave enjoyed That's My Boy. and the interviews with Rena Owen of Once Were Warriors and John Powers, who wrote the Wong Kar-wai book.
Yes.
During the pandemic, I watched Beau Travail following your passionate discussion. I didn't really care for it.
Thank you.
Okay, Robert. However, I did find an unexpected Australian connection. The song Kiss Kiss, which plays during the opening nightclub scene, was a number one single in Australia when Holly Valance,
oh yeah,
remember her?
Yeah.
Covered it in the early 2000s. At the time, Valance was best known for her role on the show Neighbours, as is everyone in Australia. All of you get to be on Neighbours for at least one episode, I think, right?
That's, you get a letter from the government telling you.
It's your turn. Go be on Neighbours. She would later go on to star as the pop star that Liam Neeson protects in the first Taken film.
Oh.
I doubt Claire Denis is aware of this link, but I think it is further evidence confirming Dave's theory that everyone in Australia eventually appears on Neighbours. I beat you to it, Robert. Linoleum Knife has been a source of pleasure in my life for many years, and I hope it continues for many more. Oh, it's continuing for many more.
We're not going anywhere.
Like, until one of us dies or loses our ability to speak or whatever. But
we are here.
This is the one thing that we cannot be fired from. So this is, you know. Please knife my list.
Okay.
Of some films that I discovered through your recommendations.
Yeah.
Minding the Gap.
Oh, so good.
Dark Horse from Todd Solondz that you didn't like and I loved.
Yeah.
Mysterious Skin.
Ooh, great.
A Face in the Crowd.
Great.
Lean on Pete.
Great.
Where's My Roy Cohn?
Oof, yes. Mm-hmm.
Better Watch Out.
Mm-hmm.
Christine, starring Rebecca Hall.
Wow, yeah.
Devastating film. Paddington's The One and the Two.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Sweeney's Letting Go of God.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yay.
Rob?
I like all those other ones so much that I'm going to let you have Dark Horse.
Your list is 100% knife. You, however, for not liking Beau-Travail.
That's another reason why I gave you a bonus.
You are only 90% knife, Robert. I'm sorry to report. You're just going to have to live with that.
People know, Dave White.
Do better.
People know the truth.
You and Robert.
Uh-huh.
You can both do better.
Yeah, you can take a seat on the war horse.
On a merry-go-round that is all composed of war horses.
War horses and dark horses.
And Balthazars.
Yes. There you go. The Balthazars don't move, though.
They lie down.
Yes.
The Balthazars lie down in a field.
Surrounded by
sheep.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. That's our program. Thank you all for listening.
Program.
Program.
Okay.
I like saying that. Hey, did you know we have a Patreon page?
Sure.
At patreon.com/linoleumknife. We have so much other stuff happening there. You like this, you might want to listen to, I don't know, our podcast about television or our podcast about food,
right,
or our podcast about a variety of topics where we swear.
I made the best shepherd's pie for dinner.
You did.
Yesterday. Like, I know shepherd's pie is sort of like dumpy cafeteria food, but boy.
You can do it right, though.
I'm talking about it on Linoleum Knife and Fork this week. It was good.
Tidbits like that. Daily recommendations, monthly club meetings, all kinds of cool stuff. So patreon.com/linoleumknife. Check out our friends on... Well, first, check out my other podcasts, please. Breakfast All Day, Who Shot Ya, and A Film and a Movie. And check out our friends on the internet. Go see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to at Critically Acclaimed. Listen to The Schmoes Know. Dennis, Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, All Things Cozy, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Deck the Hallmark, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Workroom, The Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us that 5-star review. We will read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Check out his Twitter at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA, to see what he's up to. And thanks for joining us for 10 years plus one. And we'll be back next time with more. Until then,
goodbye.